Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On this Monday, July 22nd, 4 days after Detroit made history by filing for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, we'll spend the first half of this show breaking things down, where things stand in the nation's largest municipal bankruptcy ever. And then later in the hour, we look at what needs to be done to preserve and protect Michigan's rivers and lakes. But first, to Detroit. Assuming the Chapter 9 bankruptcy goes forward, the city will have to figure out just how to reduce billions of dollars of debt. Creditors, of course, will be pushing for the most money they can get, which means they are eyeing some of the city's most valuable and treasured assets. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports.
Kevin Orr is Detroit's state-appointed emergency manager, and he has some pretty extraordinary powers to chart the course of Detroit's potential bankruptcy and its future. Last Friday, Orr took questions from reporters. The very first question he faced was pretty much, what's for sale?
Well, right now, there's nothing for sale, including Howdy Doody.
Orr was actually referring to the Detroit Institute of Arts, whose collection includes the original puppet from the 1950s children's TV show. Though no one knows for sure, the DIA's total assets, which include masterpieces by Van Gogh and Picasso, could be worth about $2.5 billion. John Padow is a professor and bankruptcy expert at the University of Michigan. He says parts of the museum's collection could potentially be liquidated and sold off to the highest bidder, at least in theory.
So if someone came in who had a complete mathematical mind and an actuarial insight and perhaps a lawyer's sensibilities, he or she might come in and just liquidate as many of the assets as possible.
But there are lots of reasons why it's not quite that simple. For one, the museum claims the art can't be touched because it's held in a public trust. It's not clear how well that argument would hold up in bankruptcy court. But Padow says there's another argument, one that could also apply to some of Detroit's other heart and soul assets.
I can imagine an economic argument being made that, look, the Detroit Institute of Art is something that's critical to the very model, brand, spirit of the city. So if you liquidate that, you could be crushing the prospects of economic rejuvenation.
Another Detroit asset in that same spirit is Belle Isle. The Island Park in the Detroit River is a lovely natural sanctuary just east of the city's downtown. But Belle Isle also needs some major work to make it the world-class park it was in the city's heyday. Earlier this year, the state of Michigan proposed leasing Belle Isle and running it as a state park, a move that would have saved the city a few million dollars a year. But the city council rejected the plan. Now, Orr has the power to push that deal through and has said he'll do that. Of all Detroit's major assets, the city's water and sewerage department might be the most intriguing to some investors. It's long been a major source of contention between the city and its suburbs. Orr has put forth a plan that would let Detroit technically retain ownership, but essentially lease its facilities to a regional authority that would operate the system. The authority would pay Detroit for that. But not everyone is a fan of the idea. Kurt Heise is a Republican state representative from suburban Detroit. He thinks the idea still gives Detroit too much power over the system. Others fear this is a backdoor move to selling the water department altogether. And Heise says that's not completely out of the question.
I don't rule out privatization. Privatization does not always work in every circumstance.
In Chapter 9 bankruptcy, even a federal judge can't force the city to sell off assets, though he can certainly apply pressure. So Detroit's creditors might be eyeing Van Gogh, but they can really only get what the city puts on the table. As for what he plans, Orr remains coy.
We're not going to address the issues of what we're going to sell because, frankly, that's an open item to be dealt with in the future.
Assuming the bankruptcy case proceeds, Orr will have to file what's called a plan of adjustment to cut the city's debt. That should give us some more clues about what's headed for the auction block. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
Now, in the days before and after Detroit filed for bankruptcy, you didn't have to look very far to read and hear comments about Detroit that ranged from dumb to mean-spirited to outright vicious. One has to wonder, for instance, just why did actor John Hamm of AMC's Mad Men have to take a shot at Detroit while hosting the ESPY Awards last week, talking about San Francisco beating the Tigers in the World Series?
They swept the Detroit Tigers in 4 games. Now, I've been to Detroit. Frankly, it's about somebody swept that place.
And why did a coworker flying back to Detroit from an out-of-town visit hear the guys in the plane row behind her discussing the Detroit bankruptcy to be summed up by one man declaring, "I wish we could just dump Detroit into the lake. We'd all be so much better off." A Detroit Free Press reader comment on the website, "Way to go, Motown. We knew you could do it. Now everybody gets nothing." And the Twitter sphere is very busy mocking the Motor City. Just check out hashtag New Detroit City mottos. We wanted to go deeper into these attitudes. What would things like this be said if it was Chicago or Atlanta having to file for bankruptcy? How far back does this scorn for Detroit reach? And how much of this attitude permeates the halls of Congress? We're joined now by Michigan Radio's political analyst, Jack Lessenberry. And joining us from the Detroit Free Press Washington Bureau is Todd Spangler. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Does it seem that this bankruptcy filing has taken the slam Detroit cracks to a new level, or are some of us just feeling defensive since making history this way?
Well, I think we're defensive. Detroit's been a punching bag for a long time. I think a lot worse was being said at the worst of the Kwame Kilpatrick crisis. But one advantage to being old is that you have some perspective. And I can remember when New York flirted with this in the 1970s, with this famous headline, President Ford, the city dropped dead. There are all sorts of jokes about New York on the rocks. But, of course, Detroit has been, you know, there's been a lot of unfortunate news out of Detroit for a long time. And it's a good butt for comedians.
Do either of you think that if it was, say, San Francisco or Atlanta filing right now for bankruptcy, we'd be hearing some guy on the plane saying, I wish we could just dump San Francisco into the bay?
Yes. I think that if they were filing for bankruptcy, if they were to follow Detroit's example, I think you'd hear certain people saying sort of things like that. But like Jack said, this has been going on with Detroit for a long time. It's been decades in the making. For whatever advances have happened, the auto industry has come back. It hasn't translated to Detroit in any great way, and that's why everybody uses it as a punching bag.
I remember in 1989 hearing a comedian saying something like, we just need another earthquake to hit San Francisco again and finish the job. So I don't think Detroit's unique in this aspect.
Okay, I want to throw out a couple of comments that here's one from a reader on the Detroit Free Press website. Here's the quote. Detroit born and raised, Pershing High grad, watched the ineptitude over many years as Detroiters voted to protect our turf against, quote, Whitey. Finally got what you voted for. Hope you make better choices in the future. Or here is a viewer comment on WDIV's website. Pick a city, any city where Detroiters are in charge. If not already bankrupt, it's only a matter of time. It has nothing to do with anything other than inferiority, intellectual, and aesthetic. To both of you, is this white America looking at the string of black Detroit leaders and expressing pure racism that's thinly disguised as criticism of the city?
The second one, for sure.
And how, I guess, how did it become okay for that to be out there for the world to see? Is it because of the internet and you can just dump this stuff out there?
Absolutely. I think that it's become very cheap for people to express all kinds of opinions. I don't think that that's anything really new. But you can't take that as a cross section of how people really believe either. Some of these comments that you're mentioning about whether Detroit brought this on themselves and whatnot. I mean, sure, to a certain degree, you know, bad governance, bad management in the city certainly did help this along, no question about it. But there's no way to look at what's going on with Detroit and not know that the decades of flight from the city, the fact that the city and the suburbs have not really worked together, that the state has not really been a full partner in trying to help the city, that bears a lot of the consequence here too.
Oh, absolutely. And some of this goes back to a time when there were white mayors. So it's, you know, but yeah, I agree totally. The internet in many ways has been a bad thing because anybody can anonymously stick anything on the internet they want to say.
And we end up taking it as if it's representative of a larger sort of thought when often it's not.
Well, it is interesting what you had pointed, both of you pointed out, this goes back to white leaders. The historical roots go back to white mayors and white leaders. But certainly the general public who's issuing these kinds of comments obviously does not get that.
Sure. I think that whether it's the general public or not, really, you could argue that one way or another. It's just very easy for people to put opinions out there, and it's empowering to folks. So they do it, and often they say, I often wonder how much people really mean with what they say. Often they're trying to be glib. They're trying to make a comment that it's hard to find even them believing sometimes. I can't tell you the number of Greece comments that I've got. The fact that Detroit's another example of Greece that I've seen in the last several days. It's people trying to be clever in a lot of cases, whether the facts match up with it or not.
Now, you also, I think, have to remember, of course, race is always with us. That's always a factor. But Detroit is sort of a unique city in that it really was a small town for most of its existence during the Depression, during the automotive era. hundreds of thousands of people flooded in. The city grew by sixfold in population, and then these people moved out again. So, and everybody has their own mythical image of what Detroit should be, the mythical Detroit. And since today's Detroit is not like that, they pile on the people who are there.
That was Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Radio's political analyst, joined by Todd Spangler, D.C.-based reporter for the Detroit Free Press. We'll continue our conversation with both of them in a moment. And then we asked just what a Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing really means for the rest of the state. Will the filing have a ripple effect on Michigan's economy? That conversation in 15 minutes. And here on Stateside, we always want to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. On Twitter, at Stateside Radio. And find us on the website, michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing now our conversation with Jack Lessenberry, our political analyst, and Todd Spangler, D.C.-based reporter for the Detroit Free Press, as we explore the attitudes, both statewide and nationally, about Detroit and the bankruptcy filing. Todd, to you now. It makes me wonder, just how is Detroit, the city, its problems, viewed by Congress, both the Michigan delegation, but also in other states?
Well, among the delegation, I think it's viewed very carefully in much the same way it's viewed at the state level. You could see last week when word of the bankruptcy came down that really the comments from the delegation came very slowly, if at all. I'm still waiting to hear something from Congressman Dingell and something from Sandy Levin. I mean, people you would expect to have had something to say. People realize that Detroit has had this fiscal problem brewing for a long, long time, and now that they've taken this step, they're not surprised. They don't necessarily want to jump on any given bandwagon yet. There's a lot of sort of, you know, keeping their powder dry to see how this is going to play out politically as well as in court. I think that's why you see the Obama administration essentially taking a hands-off approach at this moment as well. Detroit is seen as a problem, as a place where bad governance has not served the people well, as a place where money has been lost through corruption and through waste, that's not something that people in Michigan, I think, are necessarily proud of here. They love to point at the resurgence of the auto industry, for instance, but when it comes to how city government is run, it's not something that people are proud of in D.C.
This is also a very, very complicated situation, and the Free Press deservedly won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing Kwame Kilpatrick's corruption, but that was relatively simple. The economic complexity of this is so great that I'm not convinced anybody understands it.
I couldn't agree more.
It is interesting as far as comments or lack thereof from our congressional delegation. One might understand why Republicans would perhaps tread lightly. It seems surprising that Democratic war horses like Sandy Levin and John Dingell have been silent.
Well, I think the opposite. Go ahead, Todd.
No, I was going to say that, in fact, when you look at what happened with the Chrysler and General Motors bailout, it's not so surprising. I mean, in those cases, you had Governor Granholm and Senator Levin basically saying, don't let these companies go bankrupt. If you even attach the word bankruptcy to these companies, they'll never sell another car. Well, obviously that's not what happened. I mean, they found a way to do it and do it right. I think you see a certain amount of people saying we don't have funds to give you. This Congress is not going to pass a legislation that's going to bail out Detroit. So you have to see how this bankruptcy is going to play. Is there a plan in place? And besides that, it's very, very difficult. The bankruptcy court is not going to restructure the city government. They're not going to tell the city that it has to have this kind of governance structure or these kind of people running it. And barring that, you know, you may get rid of debt, but you may end up with the same situation after this happens unless the state takes steps to fix that.
The other problem is, and Todd's exactly right, at the end of the day with the GM and Chrysler bankruptcies, they had a product to sell. They had vehicles to sell. Detroit may be shorn of its debt, but it's not clear what it has to make it economically viable going forward.
You touched on, Todd, the fact that the White House has been very quiet about this. And the Free Press had Stephen Henderson's big front page story on Sunday's paper. Why is the White House so aloof? You had Vice President Biden the day after the filing saying, we don't know how the federal government can help Detroit. Does anyone think they would be saying that if Chicago was in financial ruin? Jack?
I'm not sure. It would depend on the nature of Chicago. It depends on, first of all, it's not clear what they can do. I mean, what are they going to do? You have to go through the bankruptcy process. No one is in their right mind suggesting that the federal government give Detroit $19 billion to take care of the unfunded liabilities and then continue with the same governance structure. So I think if Chicago was in this kind of shape for the same reasons, you'd have an identical response. It's not to say that down the line the president may not do something, but he's sensitive to a lot of realities. And the fact is, Republicans control the House of Representatives. That's the House where all sort of economic bills have to originate, and they're not going to do diddly squat for Detroit.
Well, I'd also remember that, you know, back in 2008, when legislation went before a Democratic House and Senate to try to bail out the car companies, it didn't pass. It failed.
Exactly.
It took you know, a Republican president to say, to take TARP, a bill created for something else, and say, we're going to take some of this money, bridge this over to the new president, Obama comes in, and then let him decide. And even then, he was very close to letting Chrysler go and insisted on seeing plans, a couple different iterations of plans from these companies before he said, okay, we're willing to fund this. I mean, I think they have a certain ground game that allows them to say, wait a second, we're not going to just start throwing money at this. Let's see what happens in bankruptcy court. Let's see if there's a plan to move forward. I think you'll see some sort of help from the federal government at some point. What that is remains to be seen, but that's going to be in large part measured by what is the city's plan going forward.
I think also to touch on something you said, Cindy, politically, this is actually much harder for Democrats. Republicans can sort of bash Detroit with impunity. They don't get any votes there. Snyder got 5% there, and that's better than most of them do. Whereas Democrats, it's very delicate. If they alienate Detroit voters, they have no prayer of winning a close statewide election in Michigan. So they have a difficult line to walk.
This does raise some interesting questions, though, for the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race next year, I would think, though, because how does Oakland County, how does Macomb County look at this vis-a-vis Snyder? I mean, I find that a fascinating political question.
What do you think, Jack?
I think that Todd's exactly right, and we don't know exactly how that's going to play out. Now, it used to be, of course, that Macomb and Oakland County politicians won elections by bashing Detroit, but there's much more of a sense that everybody's in this all together. Oakland County has been trending Democratic more and more. It voted for Snyder, certainly, but in presidential elections, it no longer votes Republican. And I think that everybody's going to be pretty cautious about this. This is not the 1970s when Brooks Patterson and Coleman Young threw pies at each other every time either of them ran for office.
Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry. We're also speaking with Detroit Free Press Washington, D.C. reporter Todd Spangler. Jack, can these critics, if we want to say the word haters, can they be won over and convinced to take another more constructive look at Detroit? And if so, how would that happen?
Some of them are going to not be confused by reality at all, but I think it's going to depend on how this bankruptcy how this goes forward, how this is structured, what the plans are for getting out of it, what's revealed, who takes the worst kind of hit. There's so many unresolved questions. I'm certainly not a lawyer, but even the lawyers say there's a lot of things they don't know about. And again, a lot of these people became the sensible people, the sort of sensible center, don't feel the same way they did about Detroit in the 1970s and 1980s. A lot of these people admire Mayor Bing, admired Mayor Archer, and there's a lot of residual goodwill for Detroit. So I think there's going to, at some point, cooler heads are going to say, we really need to worry about fixing the problem, not the blame.
I just think that this is going to end up, I think that the idea of the bankruptcy and shedding some of this debt is going to be very painful for a lot of people, but could ultimately help the city's finances, put it in a good place. But inevitably, the state and Southeast Michigan politicians have to look at the fact that, do they want this to be a city that the state can be proud of, and that it is not a liability but a positive going forward? If they were to move in that direction, create some kind of regional authority, maybe merge, maybe just make some kind of political changes that could help it going forward, then this will be a good thing. If those things don't happen, who knows?
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say something I've said for a long time, and an urbanologist believes, that the only long-term solution is to merge Detroit and Wayne County. There's a lot of political resistance to that, but the legislature could do that by simply passing a law. Cities are the creation of a legislature. In other places, that has worked pretty well, and this might be an opportune time, given post-bankruptcy, given the fact that Wayne County hasn't been doing too well itself, certainly from a governmental perspective. At some point, you're going to have, if not a complete merger, more and more regionalism. We're seeing that with a rapid bus service, but the idea that Detroit is some kind of a self-sufficient, totally autonomous island is remarkably stupid, whether white conservatives or militant black folks in the city are uttering it.
That was Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lessenberry, and he was joined from Washington by Detroit Free Press D.C. reporter Todd Spangler. As always, gentlemen, you've given us lots to chew over. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
No matter who's commenting or offering expert opinion on Detroit's bankruptcy, everyone seems to agree on the fact that this is uncharted territory, and that's about all they agree on. Take the speed of the bankruptcy. You'll find experts who predict a slow, torturous process. And just as easily, you'll find predictions that Kevin Orr will move this bankruptcy faster than anyone expects. Well, what does all of this mean for other cities in Michigan and the state's economy? So many questions, so many opinions. And that's why we're very glad to welcome into the studio Eric Scorsone, economist with Michigan State University and an expert on the ins and outs of municipal finance. Thanks for being here, Eric.
Thank you.
Well, you have said that the so-called legacy costs, in your view, are the number one reason Detroit has had to file for bankruptcy. And I should note, in reading comments online about this entire story, that term legacy cost certainly seems to rub some folks the wrong way. But it really is all about the pensioners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the term simply refers to costs that the city's incurred over many years related to pensions and health care. And that is the biggest – they are the biggest creditor. I mean, that's a simple fact. It's not to say whether they're going to be reduced or not, because we don't know. But
right. It
is the same problem that face many other communities as well.
And it's nothing judgmental or pejorative regarding the pensioners, because they certainly did their bit, worked for the cities, paid into their funds, and it's sad timing for them.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, clearly we recognize the work they did, and people, you know, expected to have a pension. So they didn't expect to be here. And really, they should be frustrated as well with the city, because it clearly didn't manage the funds properly. You know, didn't ask either for enough contributions or didn't get a good enough investment return. And I think pensioners in other cities should really be scrutinizing their own systems and saying, you know, are these promises backed by real money or not?
And along with the legacy cost, you characterize the decline in revenue as breathtaking. So it seems that you're kind of factoring out the mismanagement and corruption, which makes it, I think, very easy for others to say, well, that's Detroit's problem. We'll keep that's you know, all the history in Detroit. You're looking at factors that affect cities all throughout Michigan.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Detroit has had its issues with management, but I think you have to look at the reality that many Michigan cities have the same issues. You know, revenue sharing has been cut dramatically under both Governor Granholm and Governor Snyder. Cities that rely on the income tax, like Detroit, like Flint, have had major reductions there. And the housing bust has led to, you know, continuing reductions in the property tax. So, you know, this is a system where the architects of that system are the legislature and the governor. They decide how cities tax, what they can tax. So, you know, they're in this together. I mean, to blame one side or the other at this point, I think it's both sides, quite frankly.
I'm speaking with Michigan State University economist Eric Scorsone, who is a specialist in municipal finances. And I'm interested who's on your watch list, Eric? What other cities in Michigan are in danger of getting socked in by these double whammies of legacy costs and decline in revenue?
Well, some of the larger communities that we've looked at, Flint, you know, which has an emergency manager right now. I think the city of Saginaw certainly has to be looked at. I think the city of Lansing has to be looked at. Even the ones that you think are doing well economically still have these issues, like Grand Rapids, you know, and those kind of communities. So it tends to be our larger cities where they've had, you know, long-term decline in their populations or workforce. And even sometimes when they haven't had those issues, they still have these problems. So probably the major cities in Michigan, most of them, I was actually just at a meeting in Kalamazoo where this issue came up. For both the city and the county there. They're facing potential deficits in the future. So it's pretty widespread.
Give us your thoughts on the Headley Amendment of 1978 and Proposal A in 1994. And how does each of those impact the treasuries of communities in Michigan today in 2013?
Yeah, those two proposals put major restrictions on property tax revenues. And whether you agree with them or not, they do that. And they do that, quite frankly, very effectively. Mm-hmm. And so what they've done is essentially revenues can only grow at the rate of inflation or less. And if you think about it, inflation right now is like 1%. So basically revenues are growing very slow. And healthcare costs in particular for cities are growing at probably 8 to 10%. Mm. You know, and so if your expenditures are growing 3 to 4 times faster than revenues, it's pretty obvious you have a structural deficit. And that's what we basically have in Michigan today.
And the architects, especially Proposal A, nobody thought about things collapsing. They only saw growth at the time.
Right. Yeah. The people I've talked to who helped with that, yeah, definitely did not envision anything like we've seen in the last 4 years.
So what would be your prescription for, if you were writing a prescription for Michigan municipalities and for the state of Michigan, especially about Headley and Proposal A?
Well, I think it's at least fair to suggest, you know, we should have a revenue system that grows with the economy. So if the economy does well, the revenues can grow at least at the pace of the economy, you know, and I think we've maybe made it too restrictive. Mm. And I think you need to give them maybe more options. You know, do we need to look at a local option sales tax, which we've never allowed? Do we need to allow other options, more revenue sharing between counties and cities or something like that? I mean, we have to, I think, at least give options at the local level, not maybe mandate them, but at least let communities decide, do we want to do something differently?
Give them something to work with.
Exactly.
And overall, with perceptions, I guess, is what I would call this. Talk to us about the dangers of people outside of Detroit seeing this as a crisis that is south of 8 Mile and not something that affects them directly.
Right. I mean, it's pretty clear that that's going to be the case in a lot of places where, you know, that's Detroit. We knew that was going to happen. But I think people need to look at their own communities and ask, we may have these same issues. And that's not to say we're going to be filing bankruptcy soon. But, you know, long term, we need to be careful because other communities are facing these same issues. And we certainly wouldn't want to see this repeated. I think a second or third bankruptcy, that would be very serious because then the bond markets and others, investors would say, this isn't just Detroit. This is more widespread. So we want to make absolutely sure that doesn't happen.
And then therefore goes the state of Michigan. So suddenly there's that kind of stench, if you will, associated with the state of Michigan.
Yeah, absolutely. So we want to be careful that this we don't get anywhere near this problem in any other community.
What is your call to people listening to us right now throughout Michigan? What do they do?
Well, I think for now it's going to be wait and see to see how this bankruptcy plays out. I think, you know, it's going to be unfortunate because there's going to be a lot of sacrifices played out among all the different groups. And that's something we're going to have to see what happens. But I think for Michigan, we have to say, you know, this is serious. We've seen the auto industry now go through a major restructuring. We're seeing our major city go through a major restructuring. And we've got to make the best of it. And I hope, you know, we'll see a better Michigan in the future, one that, you know, is competitive, is prosperous, and that we never face these kind of problems again. We know there's going to be recessions in the future. So we need to be better prepared so that when there is a recession, we're more, you know, we're more resilient or robust to that.
And that certainly sounds like a clarion call to the folks in Lansing as well.
Absolutely, yes.
Eric Scorsone, who is an economist with Michigan State University and an expert on the ins and outs of municipal finances. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio today, Eric.
Thank you.
And you can find all the coverage that Michigan Radio has done on the Detroit bankruptcy filing. It's online at michiganradio.org. Still to come, we'll look at what needs to be done to protect Michigan's rivers and lakes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A significant amount of blue-green algae is expected in Lake Erie this summer. However, this year's algae bloom will only be about one-fifth as bad as what happened in 2011. Sandy Binn is with the citizen-based group Lake Erie Waterkeeper. She says 2011 was the worst year on record for the explosions of algae growth,
which are caused by too much phosphorus, too much runoff from the land, too many wastewater overflows, sewage deposits, stormwater runoff, manure, all of the above, rolling from the land into the water.
Binn says the runoff goes into rivers, which travel into Lake Erie, and that creates large amounts of algae, which turn the water green and hurt the water's quality. Local officials are also worried the algae could scare off people who come to fish and to swim in Lake Erie. Well, now let's shift attention away from the Great Lakes and over to another part of Michigan's water wonderland, our rivers and inland lakes. What do we need to do as a state to preserve and protect them? Joining me here in the studio is the executive director of the Huron River Watershed Council of Southeast Michigan, Laura Rubin. Welcome. Tell us, what does the Watershed Council do?
In general, we protect the entire watershed. So that's the 910 square miles in southeast Michigan. Starts up in Oakland County, Livingston, Washtenaw, Wayne County, and empties into Lake Erie. So people think of the river corridor itself, mm-hmm. but it's also all of the land area that drains to the river. That makes up the watershed. And then there's the Lake Erie watershed, which has many rivers that drain to it, the Great Lakes watershed, okay. et cetera, et cetera.
And I dare say many of us have heard that term watershed, but perhaps weren't exactly clear what it meant.
Yes, exactly. And many people think of it as only the water over the surface of the land, but also as we learn about groundwater, mm-hmm. it's where the water flows underneath the ground.
So let's talk a little history. How far do you think we as a state have come in our awareness of water protection since the Federal Clean Water Act was passed? That was 1972. How have we done since then?
We've done very well. As you'll remember, we really had a crisis with our rivers and lakes in the 60s. I mean, that's when we had lakes catching on fires mm-hmm. and we had a lot of industrial pollution. The Clean Water Act went a long way of regulating those pipes. So those pipes we see that came from pulp and paper mills, tanneries, wastewater treatment plants. The Clean Water Act required really strict technologies to clean up that. And that has spurred quite a bit of improvements in our water quality. What has shifted since then, though, is that what we call non-point source pollution mm-hmm. is the major source of pollution now.
And what is that?
That's the diffuse source of pollution that comes from all of us, our daily behaviors. It's what comes off of our roofs and our parking lots and our roadways. It's carrying the heavy metals from our cars. It's carrying the fertilizer from our lawns. It's carrying any garbage or motor oil there. It's carrying a lot of sediment, and sediment carries nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen. It also is carrying warmer water, because when water hits hot pavement, it keeps it warmer, and that water is going directly to our creeks. So now nationwide, non-point source pollution is the major source of pollution to our rivers and lakes.
And I think it would be, am I right, much more difficult to curb that and control that than, than clamping down on industry.
Exactly. Industry, you know you can go to that mm-hmm. one pipe, or you know that you can develop technologies that will meet that. Non-point source is a lot of education. I mean, a lot of it is behaviors that we have on our lawns, on our landscaping, where we choose to live. It also does have to do with policies, though, in terms of soil erosion control. You can regulate. The state just passed phosphorus law legislation that can regulate how much phosphorus goes down. So there are other strategies, but I'd say they're tenfold more in terms of all the different avenues that you need to hit. And unfortunately, with non-point source pollution, there's not one magic bullet. You can't okay. really say,
if this,
we can only do this.
Well, what
so
about,
it's really a multifaceted approach.
What about personal responsibility and behavior changes and modifications? What can we do individually?
It's very important at the home site. Mm-hmm. One of the things people can do is the next rainstorm, go out, see where your water is hitting your roof, going to your gutter. A lot of times those downspouts from the gutters are directly connected to your driveway or your street. redirect those. Redirect those to a grassy area, an area that has some native plants that take that up, something that can store and infiltrate that. Two of the common things that have come about are rain gardens and rain barrels, and you hear more about this. Rain barrels have a little nostalgia to them, but that's capturing some of that rainwater and reusing it in our garden. And not only is it helping the river in terms of reuse, but it's saving the homeowner money. Because rather than watering and paying a high water bill.
Sure. So instead of having it running down your driveway and into the gutter.
Yes.
You're actually making use.
And a lot of this is thinking about rain or stormwater as a resource. Mm-hmm. Historically, because Michigan is such a wet area, swampy area, we developed drain commissioners when we came first to the state to drain the water off the land. We have a mentality that we want to get water off as fast as we can and away. And
because who wants a leaky basement?
Who wants a leaky basement? Or flooding.
Sure.
You know, all
sure.
those kinds of things. And we now need to really, if we're going to protect our lakes and our streams, see water more as a resource. Mm-hmm. See it as something that we can keep on site. It's beautiful. We can reuse. It's an ethic that's definitely out in the West where water shortages are, at the forefront of everybody's mind. Here they aren't as much. But clearly water conservation and water reuse is catching on.
What about climate change?
Climate change, I think regardless of whether it's human-induced or not and some of the controversy out there, we are seeing changes in the severity of our storms, the intensity, the rainfall that's coming within a four-hour period, a two-hour period, and we're also seeing an intensity in the droughts. So we have last summer where we had a severe drought, and then we have this year where the first 6 months, I think, is the third wettest summer on record for 6 months. We're going to see more of this wide variety, these climatic swings, or as people call them, weirdness.
Weirdness. And what does that do to the rivers and lakes?
Well, one of the things we're trying to do is we're trying to help our communities be more adaptable to that, have greater adaptation so that what happens is we get these huge influxes of water. We saw on June 27th in Ann Arbor, streets flooded, people canoeing and kayaking down them. We need to have the infrastructure, not only pipes and gray infrastructure, but the green infrastructure, the wetlands, the floodplains, the forests that can absorb that water and slowly release it back into the river. Similarly, when we have droughts, wetlands, floodplains, our groundwater, they store that water. And then in the drought period, they are slowly releasing that into the system. We saw Grand Rapids this spring, severe flooding.
Very.
We saw what happened last year to our cherry crops, our apple crops, our fruit crops. This kind of climatic swings, we have to learn how to adapt and adjust to it. So as the Watershed Council, we've really been working with, sort of our stakeholders, the people who deal with water infrastructure, natural infrastructure, in-stream flows, dam operators. How are you going to put these climatic scenarios into your planning models so that when the city is looking at building a new development or redevelopment or parking lot, how do you size the pipes? What should the sizing be like? How much, again, gray infrastructure versus green infrastructure? And a lot of the communities throughout Michigan are starting to incorporate green infrastructure to a much greater extent than ever before. Detroit is a great example. They're looking at a lot of aging infrastructure, a combined sewer stormwater system. They don't have the resources to invest a lot. So a lot of it is they have land. They can put in rain gardens. They can do tree plantings. They can put in some of this green infrastructure that will help offset the load that normally goes to the big pipes.
I'm speaking with Laura Rubin, who's the executive director of the Huron River Watershed Council of Southeast Michigan, and looking at our rivers and our lakes and discovering how healthy they are and what we need to do to preserve and protect them. And we have to spend some time talking about the fact that this month marks the third anniversary of the Enbridge oil spill near the Kalamazoo River. So you had 800,000 gallons of oil that spilled out from that pipeline owned by Enbridge. First of all, from your perspective, how has the cleanup progressed?
It's been slow. You know, I think there have been a couple hurdles there, hurdles just in terms of the technology that we have in our pipeline system to respond to these things, the shutoff valves, the emergency controls. They're weaker than we would like to see, and that's something that has to be addressed at the federal level. But I think also in terms of the kinds of oil transportation that we're dealing with. This was crude heavy oil. It's not what we're used to. Most people think of Exxon Valdez, other things, mm-hmm. where you put the booms out and the oil is sitting on the top of the water. One of the things that made this spill so complicated is that it was heavy, it was sticky, it was the tar sands oil. It sinks and we don't know where it moves. We don't know, you know, they're still finding out. Just this summer, they have three huge cleanups where, again, they're pulling out the entire bottom of a river, either the riverbank or an impoundment, and hauling it off. This is 3 years later. It's become the most expensive inland oil spill. And I'm actually surprised there's not more national attention on this, especially around discussions with the Keystone Pipeline, pipeline expansion in the state of Michigan. I know in the Huron, we're very concerned about the expansion of the pipeline system. They've just bought a new line just south of Ford Lake and Belleville Lake that's going to be carrying this heavy crude oil. And we're very concerned about the regulations that are there, the cleanup technologies, the understanding of what it's all about.
And just how you strike the balance between the fact that we need
yes.
the oil
yes.
and we coming from Canada closer than coming from the Middle East, and we need to be the masters of our destiny in more of a way than we have been yet. You see
yes.
something like this.
Yeah. And you have the interplay with fracking that's going
yes.
on in this state, too,
yes.
where we're really struggling with now with the Marcellus Shale, mm-hmm. You know, in the upper lower peninsula and in the UP, what that is doing, what kinds of regulations, what we've seen some of the impacts potentially in Pennsylvania, New York. You know, there are trade-offs with all of these different kinds of energy use. And so a lot of it really comes down to, you know, where can we find efficiency? Where can we find cleaner sources? What are the best and most secure energy sources for us? But they're tough, tough questions.
With no easy answers.
Right.
But are you hopeful for the continued preservation of Michigan rivers and lakes? Do you feel hopeful? Do you feel worried?
I'm very hopeful. We have a wonderful project called River Up, and many communities throughout Michigan have similar projects. This is a project that really brings the focus back to our rivers and really makes them a focal point of our communities. We call it a river renaissance, and that's a heavy word.
Mm.
But historically, we had our backs to the river. They were used for industry and navigation, and they were undesirable places. And we are now seeing that our rivers are a tremendous asset to our communities. They're our dominant natural feature that we have. They are a source of economic vitality, recreational vitality, cultural, and they give us a sense of place. And so with this effort, we have been overwhelmed by the response from our private and public partners on revitalizing the Huron, making it the main streets of our communities.
Not the toilet.
Not the toilet, exactly. So, you know, we have the cleanup of the DTE Mishcon property in Ann Arbor that has been sitting there for, you know, decades, really heavily contaminated, wanting them to be a part of this river revitalization, turn it into an attractive amenity for the city, bring in a restaurant, some, you know, vitality mm-hmm. there. In Grand Rapids, we have that community talking about removing the four small cofferdams in downtown and bringing the rapids back to Grand Rapids. And it is part of the placemaking, the vitality of the downtown. People are interested in putting up commercial and residential along our riverfronts. In Traverse City, we have the Boardman River, where they're taking out three dams there. And they talk about the community reinvestment. You know, in addition to the environmental benefits of removing the dams, that community really sees it as a revitalization project. So that makes me very optimistic about the future of Michigan's rivers and lakes, in that people see that You know, one of the core values of Michigan is our natural resources and the beauty. You know, yes, we're surrounded by all the Great Lakes, but, you know, we have 36,000 miles of river and over 11,000 lakes. And that's a tremendous resource. And as people look relocating businesses and wanting to be more around high quality of life, and that's becoming more important, that's a great asset that Michigan has.
Your passion for rivers is just shines out. What drives that? Where did that come from?
I grew up along Lake Michigan, and I've always loved water. I love getting in it, swimming in it. I love sitting by it. And I also truly believe, I also have a business background. I truly believe that our business interests and our environmental interests can go hand in hand. I know you've had John Austin here talking about the blue economy and the green economy. I think it's wonderful opportunities that we have here. And you can see the sparks in our community of people who have that vision of developing a waterfront business or a livery or a water-related industry and green technologies. And it's so exciting in this state because we are in a transition in our economy of developing, you know, new economies, less of the large manufacturing. And I think we have great opportunities.
And with opportunity, the other side of the coin would be threats. So in your view, really spell out what you see as the biggest threats and the things we most need to be on guard against.
Well, I think a lot of it is how we do redevelop the state. I think we need to keep strong wetlands control, strong sand dune protections. And this state has been very good on that in the past. And it's balancing some of those business needs with those environmental needs. I think we need good leadership at the state for that, at the local level, but also community support. When people come out and talk about their passions for the lakes and the rivers, that's wonderful. It adds to it. And also when we can try to provide more of an economic value to our angling businesses and our fishing and recreation and tourism, that boosts that blue economy that we've talked about.
We've been speaking with the executive director of the Huron River Watershed Council of Southeast Michigan. Laura Rubin, it's been a pleasure to have you here in the studio with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
And finally, this note as we end the hour. 8 people were arrested today during a protest against construction of an oil pipeline in mid-Michigan. Enbridge Energy is installing a new, larger pipeline to replace the line that broke 3 years ago. That break dumped more than 800,000 gallons of crude oil into the Kalamazoo River. The cleanup of the tar sands oil, as we just heard, continues today. Andrew Joyce is the spokesman for the group Michigan Coalition Against Tar Sands. He says the group fears the new pipeline will not prevent a similar spill from happening again. 4 of the protesters attached themselves to heavy equipment at the work site. An Ingham County spokeswoman said the protesters will be charged with trespassing. This is the second time protesters have stopped work on the pipeline that will ultimately run from Sarnia, Ontario, all the way to Griffith, Indiana. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside was directed today by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Tony Brown. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Katie Suha, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.